What would you little maniacs like to do first?
Burning bright right till the end. Now you'll be missing from the photographs, missing from the photographs.
Hey y'all, welcome back to the show. Today is September 24th, and you are about to hear my first discussion, but not my last, with Christina Hoff Summers. Consider this like an introductory interview. So a couple of things that we didn't get to, I really wanted to get her impression and really have her elaborate on her feelings about libertarian feminists, a group of people who have, from what I've read, very mixed opinions of Ms. Summers. In fact, about 10 minutes into the conversation, you'll hear me ask a question as a prompt. It's about her spending more time in libertarian circles. And that was my way to get into that discussion. But unfortunately, this moved at such a fast pace that we really didn't get into the detail I wanted there. So definitely something to do with her in the future. Our discussion focuses mostly on her recent experiences in academia, as I mentioned in an earlier show, it would. But we also, referencing her book, The War Against Boys, talk about lower levels of school as well. As I was writing the show notes for this podcast, I was so disappointed that there were so many questions that I didn't get to, so many topics left unexplored. But like I said, we can definitely get her back for another discussion. Now, folks, some production notes, okay? This is a little unfortunate. I was doing this show while I was on the road. I'm going to tell you the whole story. I want you to know what goes into what you're about to hear. So I can't bring my whole production studio when I travel. And I had to go and see my mom. And I was there for a few days. So I brought my little Zoom recorder. I brought a microphone and a telephone. Cellular. A nice one. My plan was to hook up the microphone to the Zoom to record my voice and then use my mom's MacBook to capture Christina's audio while I called Christina through Skype on the phone and spoke to her through the internal speaker in the Mac computer, reassuring her that the podcast would have better audio quality. That was my plan. This is real basic. Couple hours before the show, I go to perform the simplest of podcasting tasks, download the program Audacity on my mother's Macintosh computer. Then I was going to open Audacity and set it to record the speakers, which I would monitor through headphones while I talked to Christina through the computer's internal microphone. Goddamn Apple computer won't let me download a program. So the default security feature on a MacBook, at least the one my mom has, is if you want to download a program, you have to put in a password. And that's just typical, you know? Like, here at Apple, we don't understand why you'd ever desire more than what we've given you. So that's a really annoying feature, but you figure it's easy to find the password. I text my mom. I say, Mom, what is the password for your MacBook? She says, I have no idea. I didn't even know it had a password. Well, shit. So now it's an hour until the interview. I have no way to record it. Then I'm reminded of something that I already mentioned. Oh, she wants to talk over the phone. So is there a way to use my cell phone and record the call? I immediately go to the Google Play Store and start looking for apps that can record calls. I read reviews. I look at prices. I find one that costs money and is very well reviewed. The people are saying 4 stars. Great call recorder. It recorded my call and then I listened to it later. I said, that's exactly what I need. But I'm a professional, so what's the audio quality going to be like, I said. So I did a couple of test calls, very short, about a minute each. And they both sounded fine. The audio quality was decent. So I said, all right, I've invested in this, and we're ready to go. I even tested with Christina before the show starts. This very busy, famous woman. I'm taking her valuable time to test a recording method. Everything checks out. So we proceed to talk for an hour as I rely on a new app to record the call. Turns out that with this app, the longer the call is that it has to record, the more it compresses the audio. Read the fine print, Brett. If you do a 2-minute call, it sounds outstanding. If you do a 60-minute call, it is in fact a different story. So, once this is all done, I feel like the interview went well for a first interview. I take the audio files and I import them into Audacity to gleefully begin editing. I import my audio from the Zoom. It's a WAV file, 250 megabytes. I go back to my phone, I go to the app, I upload Christina's audio to my Google Drive and then download it to my computer and import it into the project. Her audio file is 6 megabytes. Steve, do you have that sad music? Yeah, that's it. Thanks. So folks, that's walkie-talkie quality. And it's really unfortunate. In fact, because of that story that I just told you, I mean, you know, work went into this show. I am going to put it on Patreon. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to use the money from this show to hire a transcriber to turn this into an article on schoolsucksproject.com, which is probably good for us to do anyway. So thanks for your support. That's a look behind the scenes of podcast interviewing away from home. All right, everyone, I hope you're having a great weekend. We've got a busy October coming your way. Here's my discussion with Christina Hoff Summers, already in progress. We're going to pick up the discussion right after I read her a list of her books that I wanted to discuss in this show, Who Stole Feminism, The War Against Boys, and Freedom Feminism. Here we go. Which of those have been set on fire?
Someone on Tumblr burnt The War on Boys. They burnt my book. And then they sent it around the internet, and they seemed to be proud of it. It was this young woman. She was grinning, and apparently she hasn't studied the history of book burning. Doesn't have a distinguished history.
So see what I've done? I've poisoned the well against some of the people that we're going to talk about today. As I was prepping for this interview, I said to myself, I hope Christina can actually help me calm down a little bit. I think the experiences that I've had in the last year or so and a lot of what I've observed on these college campuses has led to an overly hostile and perhaps even simplistic view of both academia and feminism. And my conclusion at this point is the problem is not feminism. The problem is not academia, because obviously both of those have great benefits and merits. The problem seems to be where those two worlds collide and produce this kind of academic authoritarianism. Am I somewhat on the right track?
Yes, I would just add one more distinction. It's not the encounter with, you know, scholarship, the academy and feminism that is toxic. It is the encounter of the academy with hardline, male-averse, grievance feminism. This is a very special school of feminism. It's always been there, but it's gained prominence in the last year or two because of, I guess, on the internet and in women's studies, gender studies departments. Mm-hmm. And that is what's dangerous. They produce scholarship, not in any way objective. It's ideologically driven. They are increasingly intolerant of dissent, of criticism. You have to have criticism in scholarship. That's our quality control.
Absolutely.
They don't have it.
Yeah. Why don't we try to set a baseline before we go into criticism of them? For those in my audience who are completely unfamiliar with your work, what is feminism to you?
I am someone who taught philosophy for more than 20 years at Clark University and the University of Massachusetts. And I also have been a feminist since high school. But to me, feminism meant equality with men, it meant equal dignity, equal freedom, equal responsibility, and it didn't mean a war on men. It didn't mean life was a zero-sum game. We win, they lose. Mm-hmm. That's absurd. If men lose, women lose, and the other way around as well. We are in this together. So I'm very much in favor of a kind of equality-based, feminism based coming out of the European Enlightenment. and founded in the spirit of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony through this first and second wave of feminism. But the movement took a turn towards a very harsh, actually quite unhinged, in an unhinged direction.
Yeah, so I just want to continue to clarify here. I've heard you use the term equity feminism, and just because, you know, maybe we have some young folks who are listening who aren't too familiar with the distinction between equity and equality, especially when it comes to, you know, our focus, education. An equality issue would be something like equal funding for all students, while equity would be like maybe students who come from less get more to ensure they catch up. But I don't know if that's how you're using the word equity.
No, I don't make an important distinction between equity and equality. I am definitely in favor of equality feminism, and I use it interchangeably with equity feminism, so no one has to worry about that. But I distinguish it from is what I call grievance feminism or victim feminism. That is not about equality. That is about righting all of the wrongs men have done to women, keeping track of them, mm-hmm. being angry about them. And also, it assumes that you take a very paranoid view about American society. I look at American society. Of course, we have problems. We're not perfect, but we're pretty good. And I would say that young women today, especially college women, are probably the freest, the most advantaged of a group, the safest of any women anywhere, anytime, any place. And yet, they increasingly have about 20-25% of them that believe the very opposite. They believe they are oppressed. They believe they're second-class citizens, that they live in a patriarchy, in a rape culture, in a male hegemony. All of that is delusional.
I had this kind of nasty thought to myself the other day. I feel like it's a nasty thought. I feel like I'm not being understanding enough. But I look at so much of what's happened in academia just over the last 2 years, and I say to myself, and I feel, you know, like I am a straight white male, and that it, obviously there's a lot of experiences that I can't understand. How comfortable does an environment have to be? And I understand there are lots of discomforts, but how generally comfortable does an environment have to be for the phrase microaggression to come into existence?
Exactly right. And sociologists and political scientists have documented an interesting phenomenon, is that where there is the least oppression, the least inequality, you'll often have the most, sort of high levels of bitterness and grievance. And so where is the least oppression for any group, marginalized groups, probably on the American campus? Mm. I think the only group that's really marginalized and oppressed would be conservatives, and people can be mean to you, they can bully you, if you're a conservative, or even just the wrong gender and race, you're a white male, able-bodied, cisgendered person, you can be marginalized, bullied, told to shut up, and it's the paradoxes, the ironies are just limitless. It's called intersectionality. It's the latest phase on campus. Don't fall for it. It's an excuse for fanaticism and actually just meanness. And what it does is, in order to fight racism and sexism and the other isms, it practices them. So in order to fight racism, it divides everybody by race, puts them in a hierarchy. And the most culpable are the white males. And then those who are multiply marginalized, they supposedly have the greatest wisdom and the greatest right.
Yeah.
I prefer to think I think kids so you look at one another as individuals. And I think that race differences and gender differences and all that, as soon as you become friends with somebody, then you forget about that.
That's true.
And we're not allowing kids to make friends. We're immediately telling them it's psychologically so ridiculous to do this. It's just the exact wrong thing if you want to build a community of happy people and a community of friends. We're building a community of tribes, warring tribes. And the dangerous thing is there's also a scapegoat where you can focus all your grievance and animosity, which is the white male. So who needs that? you know, there may be some white males on campus who deserve opprobrium, but I'm sure there are people of all descriptions that you might not like. And there's the opposite, people, wonderful people, sweet, good, kind people. You have to judge by the character. And, you know, this is Martin Luther King. Why do we do the opposite in the name of inclusiveness?
How widespread do you think this problem is in colleges and universities right now? I mean, we're always seeing, like, what shows up on YouTube and Twitter and Tumblr is always the most vocal and usually the most intolerable people. But there's got to be a rational conversation on a lot of these issues happening. That's like not what's showing up in your video with Steven Crowder from UMass, right? It's not all just complete chaos. There has to be some kind of rational drive behind a lot of this ugly stuff we're seeing, right?
You're absolutely right. I think the majority of students on campus may be somewhat apathetic. And you've got a small group. It depends on the school. I think the more elite, the more privileged, perhaps the larger the aggrieved group. So if you go to a precious little environment like Oberlin College or Swarthmore, you will find a huge number of people who are chronically offended, aggrieved, blaming everyone. Be careful of those schools. I hate to say that because as an academic, those schools used to be synonymous with excellence. And a young man or woman, any background could go there and get a solid, serious, superb education. Not anymore. I mean, you can navigate your way around and find good teachers, but you're going to find a lot of highly ideological professors who are sorry to say this, but who teach straightforward propaganda, gender propaganda, race propaganda, anti-West, anti-America. You know, I can be critical of the West and critical of the United States, of course, but you also have to give us our due in our achievements and what we have, you know, where we have come compared to other societies. This is just not done in too many places.
Yeah, I worry about collectivism generally. Everybody needs to be seen as an individual and measured on their own achievements. And I try to apply the same thing to nationalistic identity. I think you're making that distinction, too. I've always kind of been irritated by people saying things like we went to the moon or when we invaded Vietnam. But there is a tradition in Western civilization that is important. As you pointed out, it's far from perfect.
Improvement, lots of horrible lapses and tragedies, but overall, the direction, it's whatever it is in this tradition, it put us in the direction of progress, of compassion, of inclusiveness, and it's something to be proud of. I mean, feminism is a phenomenon of bourgeois capitalism. It came out of, you know, those Western traditions. It provided the material prosperity that made possible to liberate everyone, first of all, from very harsh living conditions. It created a middle class. If you have a middle class, that means you have a vast number of people who are who have the good life, who aren't elites. So you want to, you know, encourage that. And there are different ways to do it. You don't have to do it strictly as Americans do. I admire the Swedes, the British, and so forth, but we're all working in that direction, and something has to be understood. But so much time in schools, including high schools, is that simplistic denigration of the West, of freedom, of free expression, of due process. And I worry to me that there are students, high school and college students, that for whatever reason we're not taught to cherish these traditions and protect them. And you cannot take them for granted. It takes generations to evolve into a liberated society with due process and respect for individual rights. And it can take very little time to tear it down. And it will be torn down if people are indifferent to it or people are fighting it. They would only do that, in my opinion, because they don't understand it.
Sure. So you've spent probably more time than you once did in libertarian circles. Is that correct?
I like libertarians. I like a lot of groups. I mean, even occasionally I will speak at a campus mm-hmm. and tangle with the radical feminists, but later we'll go out for drinks or they'll follow me to hassle me. We end up having a fun conversation. That actually happened at Oberlin at a bar afterwards. I had an interesting conversation, but I can get along. I can get along with almost anybody if they're just willing to chat, to be able. I'm open to the possibility that I am wrong. I have spent years looking into, standard feminist statistics, mm-hmm. and I find that they are badly, often completely wrong. Often, I would say almost always misleading, oversimplified, based on dubious research. And going back to what we said in the very beginning, in any other field, this would be corrected because there's a tradition of criticism and you have to be reviewed by peers. That's the tradition.
Yeah, I would have to think that this is a problem that plagues many different areas beyond gender studies and academia. And you actually taught gender theory at one point, right?
I taught it at Clark University, as I said, when I was a professor. And I was asked to teach it by the chair of my department. And I thought, okay, I'm feminist. I'm a philosopher. I'll teach feminist philosophy. And I was pretty shocked by what I read in the books. It was so outrageous. And I didn't even mind it being outrageous. That's fine. I had assigned outrageous thought. I've assigned Nietzsche. there's a lot in philosophy that's shocking. Oh, Nietzsche is shocking. Not to it is brilliant, but it can be very shocking. But then you provide the counterpoint. You provide the other side. They don't provide the other side.
Yeah, and you talked a lot about specious research. Are there examples of the gender studies research, places where you identified like serious glaring errors?
Oh, yes. Pick any topic you want. If you look into the research, the feminist or gender studies research on education, on women and mental health, on violence, on women in the workplace, any domain, what you find is that it's always bad news, it's always a crisis of, male predation and female victimhood. It's the same drama rehearsed, replayed over and over and over again. They never tire of it. Their figures never change. It's always, this massive numbers of women, 1 in 3 being battered, 1 in 4 in college being raped. They claim that, massive levels of depression and all of this. None of it's true.
Well, could you explain how those numbers are acquired then? I mean, is it all confirmation bias? And I ask because I'm not an academic and I'm worried that I often have this simplistic negative view of what is happening, that people aren't even attempting to do research. There must be ways they get this 1 in 4 campus rape figure.
I'll tell you how they do it. There are a number, first of all, it stipulates there is sexual violence on campus. It's because it's such a heinous problem that I think we should treat it in a sober way and try to get a real understanding, real numbers. That's not what's going on. People are opportunistically exaggerating it for their own purposes. Maybe. How do you exaggerate it? A number of ways. You can... as some people do, you ask you ask a non-representative group of, in this case, young women. You ask them vague questions, and you make no distinctions. For example, I'll just give a silly example, then I'll give a real one. Suppose I asked someone, "Did you ever kick, or while you were growing up, were you ever kicked or hit by a brother or sister?" Mm-hmm. And if you ask that, you know what? Almost everybody has a brother or sister says yes. Well, then you say, okay, epidemic of family violence in the United States. 1 out of 3. Well, when we think of family violence, we don't think of brothers and sisters.
Right.
But they will, so what they will do is they will ask, have you ever, there were a lot of girls on campus, did anybody ever attempt to grab you or kiss you, and that goes under the rubric of a sexual assault. Now, that could be an assault, But people think of it as in the same category as rape, so it begins to seem like, okay, then they're all being raped. Well, no, there is a lot of acting out and people grabbing each other and doing things, and especially at parties while drunk. Now, that is a problem, I agree, but it should not be in the category of someone being thrown out of school and their lives ruined as a sex predator.
Right, of course, yeah.
So they ask vague questions with vague definitions to a non-representative sample. And they've got an epidemic of sexual assault on every campus in America. But they don't make a distinction between someone attempting to kiss you and a violent rape. That's a problem.
Well, what do you think of this? I know that there's probably a lot of not really recognized emotional drivers behind a lot of this narrative that's being pushed. So I'll speak to an example that I understand. Being a libertarian, not pro-state, I'll maybe even say anti-state. And what I've observed from other libertarians is there's this kind of glee that happens when we see a problem that is clearly the result of government, right? So people, and you see a lot of this on Facebook, people go out and they become these like tragedy collectors. They don't think about the actual, negative impact on some innocent person because of police violence or because of the IRS or Homeland Security. They just say, good, another check mark in the I'm right column, and they post it on Facebook. So in this goes all the way through academia, it sounds like, that same general idea that people aren't really, really being objective once they're in these very, very insular environments. They become effectively tragedy collectors.
Yes, and they become, the new word, I guess, is the repressive left, the alt-left. They are, and this brings out the libertarian in me. I mean, when I went to college, no one went to dorm counselors. I don't even think we had them. We just lived in the dorm, and there was, if you made noise or something, there was campus security that might come and tell you to be quiet. There were no rules. And, I mean, except, that it would be in any community. We were adults. We were considered adults. You didn't go crying to a dean because your roommate insulted you. You might have to change your room if you were some impossible person, but that was about it. And usually they say no, go on. So now you see today this growing industry of counselors and diversity officers and these titles, it's just infinite numbers of titles. You can play games with kind of conjuring up the new titles for all these new bureaucrats, these apparatchiks on the campus. Such students can run to mommy or daddy so they have a safe space and feel that they haven't been micro-invalidated. This is madness. And it's the opposite of freedom. And it's the opposite of feminism. Feminism, as I said, was about agency, responsibility. You go back and read Simone de Beauvoir. I don't agree with everything she said, but she had some brilliant insights about what it meant to be a responsible agent and a person, a master of your destiny. Where is that today? What happened?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, she was French, right? She was a postmodernist, second wave. Oh, I think it was called The Second Sex was one of the books she wrote.
Yes,
and
yes,
the thrust was that women need to stop accepting a kind of relegation.
You should define yourself and not be defined. But she borrowed a lot from the existentialists, from her Jean-Paul Sartre, so she had a lot of this existential notion of radical freedom and personal responsibility. That was so exciting to me as a young college student to read that, and that was what feminism meant. It wasn't about blaming men. It wasn't about blaming anybody. It was about personal empowerment. And liberation is the word we use, emancipation. And so today, I call it fainting couch feminism. It's a kind of protective hysteria running to, as if women are fragile little birds that need to be protected from, off-color jokes or sexual innuendos that could send us into a tailspin. It could trigger us. It's about turning women into children. It's the reverse of feminism.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's almost the academic environment that is more of a problem than feminism itself. And I mean, this is where the plot really thickens for me. Is it like you said, you align yourself and you really identify with first and second wave feminism, and especially first wave feminism has this really strong classical liberal tradition. These gender studies students today, that must be a part of the curriculum, the history of feminism, and that must, maybe I'm just terribly naive, but those things must be taught. Why don't they embrace that? Why do they go in this very radical, I've heard you call it gender feminism.
Well, I use a lot of
grievance feminism.
Grievance feminism, gender feminism, victim feminism, but now it's led to this fainting couch feminism.
So why aren't they embracing those other messages?
Well, for one thing, I looked carefully in that little book, Freedom Feminism. I looked at how is equality feminism treated in a gender studies class, and it's there. They learn about it, and it's dismissed for failing to be sufficiently radical. And because you have a lot of people who are, for whatever reason, they're possessed of the idea that you cannot improve our society; you have to dismantle the corrupt patriarchal institutions, and nothing short of, you know, in other words, they want to get rid of what they call the sex gender system. They want it overthrown, and so they don't like liberal reform or libertarian reform, certainly not. They want something else that requires a lot of state control. It requires sort of re-engineering people's preferences, re-socializing society in a radical way. So it's the same old story, this these pernicious, overreaching ideologies
of the left. I don't want to use the word liberal for anything that I see happening there anymore, because
it's
almost
illiberal.
Like Marxist as far as the tactics are concerned. Not Marxist, Leninist as far as the tactics are concerned.
Yeah, so, and it's also, people will say, well, there's very repressive ideas on the far right. They're right, but the far right is not in the universities and it's not in the high schools in any significant way. So I don't see it. It's not a problem in that way. It could be a problem with some, you know, random crazy people. But the far left is entrenched in the academy, and it's a repressive school. If it were the kind of leftist that I was and my friends were, it wasn't about rules. It was closer to anarchy or libertarian, personal responsibility. But today, the left is, I think, scary. They're in favor of censorship, and they want speech codes. They're disinviting speakers. They want to shut down discussion because it might hurt someone's feelings or trigger somebody. This whole thing about triggering is a lot of nonsense. Talk to any psychiatrist. There are people with PTSD, and they need help, and I very much want them to get it. If I had a student who told me, I would help in any way I can. But that is so rare. These students aren't triggered. They're using this language to manipulate people in place of argument. They won't have to argue. They just say, I want to shut you down because you give me PTSD.
Well, I don't know if I agree completely, and I'll explain what I mean. Like, I've had things said to me that had negative emotional consequences, but they happened in my head. So I understand the idea of being triggered, but if somebody says something to me and it has negative emotional consequences for me, that's a problem that I have to solve. Something that's very real. I won't use the word triggered anymore because it's been ruined if I ever used it. And the other thing is, like, as far as safe spaces are concerned, like, safety is a very basic human need. So I don't have a problem with anybody who wants safety. My problem begins with an exploration of what they want safety from. So when I heard about the dust up at Oberlin College, was that where you were, where they set up the rooms for people who thought you were going to invalidate their experiences?
I triggered 30 people. They ran out of the lecture. 30 people and a therapy dog. I triggered a dog.
So what's the bridge to build there, right? Because if you agree with me that people have valid responses, negative or troubling emotional responses, and they have this need to feel safe, and we recognize that those things are real, the problem isn't the needs. The problem is the behaviors being used to express those needs. So what do you do?
Well, actually, I think it was Jonathan Haidt and Craig Lukianoff wrote a brilliant article think in the Atlantic, about the Kabul student, and they showed that psychologically, this is the worst thing. We were actually, with this safe space trigger warning movement, creating neurosis, because it was the opposite. If you study stoicism or cognitive therapy, and they happen to be very close, I actually wrote a book with a psychiatrist called One Nation Under Therapy, and we were warning against this therapeutic culture. Because even at its own terms, it doesn't make people better. To treat people as fragile, not to credit them with the capacity for resilience and self-protection. Now, you have to teach that to children, how to be self-protecting. And even as adults, I used to enjoy teaching the Stoics, because it is a fantastic life philosophy, which does teach that, you know, people can hurt your body, but they can hurt your feelings, but you have a certain amount of control about how you react to it. And so the great readings of Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius are very inspiring, and it turns out psychologically very relevant. And that's why anybody has a problem, they should go get cognitive therapy, because it's based on stoicism, and it teaches you how with attacks. And the worst thing you could do is to catastrophize them and to give them more meaning than they deserve. So what you learn in cognitive therapy and in stoicism is to analyze, not maximize, is to cope. And you learn post-traumatic growth, not post-traumatic diminishment. So what they're doing on the college is the exact opposite of what would be advised by some of our greatest philosophers, and I think the most effective school of psychology.
Yeah, I'm really happy to hear you say all of that. We did a whole series on my show on the philosophy of Stoicism back in 2014. I'm a big fan of CBT, Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy.
Yes.
I'm actually planning to have Michael Edelstein on the show in the near future for a debate on one issue where we disagree, which is the work of Nathaniel Brandon. But I think that when you have this growth of an aggrievement industry and a culture of victimization, obviously the responsibility for the way somebody feels, there'd be a lot of outsourcing of that and blaming of other people. They go perfectly with a culture of victimization.
I just think what preparation that is for family life. You're going to be taking every little, you know, you have kids and you have a husband or a wife, a partner. You're going to have to cope with misunderstanding and not turn everything into, you know, somebody insults you. You turn it into this big deal. I think some of these anti-bullying programs are to blame. I think they've encouraged kids to. I think the intention was originally good, you know, to stop sadism in the school. We all want to do that.
Yeah.
But they went too far and started to monitor just everyday teasing and hassling that kids do and that you have to get used to. And so they created kids that think mild teasing or a mild insult or something makes you feel not, you know, perfect, but that's a big deal. You have to, you know, go and report it.
Which, you know, I mean, I've been a big critic of the schools for a long time. And despite their benevolent tone on this issue, they have some bullying tactics of their own, which I really disagree with.
Exactly. They turn it. That's the paradox, is in this effort to fight bullying, this is what the left has done. They've become, they're the worst bullies that I've ever encountered. I mean, I've disagree. As a philosopher, you're constantly debating. You go to the American Philosophical Association and give a paper, and everybody's there to show you're wrong. But it's done in a spirit of mutual respect and you know, kind of this is the tradition of argumentation and so forth. Well, now what I find, and by the way, when I used to go to campus before the rise of this safe space movement, the kids who disagreed with me would come and argue, or I'd argue with gender studies teachers. That was fine. Now, I go to the campus, and they organize their safe spaces, and they try to get me disinvited. And I'm not, I don't come there to insult anyone. It's always civil. Mm. So it's not, there's no conceivable reason, except that they don't want to hear, they don't want to have their cherished ideas challenged.
Yeah, and that has really been the biggest source of my criticisms and hostility towards academic feminism, what's happening on these college campuses, and the social justice movement generally, is the interference in free expression and free inquiry. And just to lead us down one final track of questioning before I let you go, and it relates to what we were just talking about with the schools, I think there's an even bigger problem a lot of times when government gets involved and ideology becomes policy and law. You give a startling example of this in the war against boys, the slow path of starting to pathologize normal boy behavior that seemed to begin at Harvard University with the musings of a woman named Carol Gilligan and escalated as years went by into like this UN human rights investigation, right?
Right. Absolutely absurd. And she did some kind of interesting work in the 80s called Different Voice, claiming that when women approach moral dilemmas, they tend to use a perspective of care. And this is different from men who use reason. Well, it turned out not to be true. At least no one can find any evidence of that particular difference. I do believe that there are differences between the sexes, but when it comes to moral reasoning, it doesn't appear we're different. But she claimed we were. And then after she had this idea that women had a different voice, then she went on to saying the voice was silenced. Well, who silenced it? Of course, it's a male voice. So she wanted to address this problem of toxic masculinity. And once we were there, little boys became the focus for re-education. And I think that little boys need to be educated like all kids, but this was not predicated on the assumption that we simply had to educate and civilize little boys. We had to re-socialize them away from who they are, from their boyishness. So that's part of the war against boys that comes from Gilligan.
Right. So back to bullying. And when I talk about a kind of institutional bullying of schools, when all of this flared up a couple years ago, and we did some shows on it, the question that I was asking, do you think an environment where people are like forced to be together promotes negative social interactions? I think it does. And no one would talk about that.
I think what's poisoning is you're forced to be together and then you have to be hyper conscious of every little thing you say and walk on eggshells because you might offend somebody. I think they should just leave these kids alone and let them work it out. And you know what? I think the consequence will be friendship, true friendship. I think the worst thing you can do is to make them hyper aware of differences and like, you know, oh, race differences, you're qualitatively different. If you are a white male heterosexual, you are qualitatively different from an African-American lesbian from a poor family. You know what? You might be, but you also, it might turn out that you've got affinities because you're human beings. You're unique.
Yeah.
And so you can't really judge. And I think this is getting in the way of those friendships that would, you know, kids could have got together around their interests, around their passions, joining clubs, playing sports, bringing them together that way. But to bring them together and insisting that we make a kind of fetish out of identity politics, tribalistic, divisive, unhappy.
Do you feel like those identity issues are penetrating like down to secondary school and even elementary school, which is where you're focusing on in the war on boys? Do you think it goes that far?
I don't know about with the race politics, but certainly the gender politics. There's some. What worries me is that the schools of education still teach theories like Carol Gilligan. These books are still there, and a whole raft of books on this alleged girl crisis that never was. So a lot of teachers who might have very good instincts about, you know, it is harder to teach little boys typically because if they're early grades, they act out more and they're more of a challenge. But now teachers are taught, they're not just more of a challenge and it's not, you know, they're not taught special ways to engage a little boy. They're taught how to, they have to be the allies of the girls. Mm. And this has led to, this attitude, I think, is part of the medicalization of boyhood. I'm not against Ritalin for kids who need it. There are kids who are bouncing off the walls. Most of the little boys, about 75% of little boys who are on Ritalin compared to girls. But far too many, even psychiatrists who prescribe Ritalin will tell you far too many kids are being given this drug.
But they continue to prescribe it?
I haven't documented this lately, but when I was writing the second edition of Oregon's Boys a few years ago, in some school districts, about 20% of the boys are medicated.
Yeah.
That suggests some kind of overdiagnosis, that they're medicating high-spiritedness and rambunctiousness.
Exactly. So just like with bullying, the conversation that I dream about hearing one day with regard to these schools is maybe part of this is the school. Right. I don't think any boy under 10 years old, I would like it if nobody had to be on Ritalin. There's ways to address those issues without Ritalin. But the fact that the school system needs to medicate people to keep them inside that environment, to me, that screams that there's a problem with the environment itself. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's true. And, you know, there are ways, there are teachers who are very good with boys. And by that I mean, you know, the girls tend to like school more. They're more amenable to the classroom environment, and they're a little more mature at 5 and 6 years old. And their style of play is more pleasing to typical mother and teacher. The typical play of little boys is called rough and tumble play. There's a lot of mock fighting, chasing, you know, boom, bang, sound effects.
Right.
Girls do it too, but boys do it a lot. In fact, leave them alone, they'll do it all the time. And girls do a lot of theatrical, imaginative games, exchanging confidences with a best friend, playing house, playing school. So along that, a lot of teachers interfere with boys' play. They're superhero play. They have a lot of fantasies of vanquishing bad guys and you know, killing villains. Well, this is thought to be predictive of violence. No, it's the young male imagination. It's completely natural, normal, and part of a healthy development. And there's now some studies that suggest that teachers, by always interfering with boys, the sort of things they want to write and stories they want to tell, might be undermining their literacy skills, because kids usually want to write the things they care about, but a lot of little boys aren't allowed to now, because they want to write about a monster destroying a city.
Absolutely.
And they want to write about, you know, a sword fight with pirates. And a little boy named Justin I read about in California, the teacher called his parents to school, very concerned. Justin had dreamed, look at Justin Strong, she said. He had a picture of a pirate ship and a sword fight and, you know, people's heads being cut off. And the teacher said, I'm very concerned. And the parents said, well, he likes pirates. This is how he plays. And she warned them that, you know, and by the way, this is a well-behaved little boy. He's never done anything wrong except these drawings. And the father said something so important. How can my little boy, is he going to learn? Can he learn from a teacher who has so little sympathy with his imagination? And that's sort of the question I ask in War Against Boys. I think that we don't have sympathy with the young male. The typical, there are exceptions. I'm talking about the typical boy. And I think that it's true of girls, too. The girls, there's now a lot of angst over the way little girls play. It's when they're playing princess. But I've read very good analysis. When girls play princess, there's also power struggles and inventive, complicated scenes, just as in the boys play. So that was my latest factual feminist. I did an analysis of this claim that children are hurt by gendered play. And I don't see evidence of that.
Yeah. Just back to the teacher who was concerned about the pirates' sword fighting, did she offer the parents, as far as you know, did she offer the parents any kind of reasoned justification for her concerns other than the appearance of swords?
Oh, she thought it was self-evident. There were swords. There were battles. And she thought, from her perspective, and I mean, I'll tell you, as a, you know, when I was younger, I didn't like sword fights, and I thought, I mean, even now, I don't like violent shows. So I can understand that's not to the teacher's taste. But if you're if you're a teacher, you have to have sympathy with the preferences and interests of your kids in order to teach them. And I think that many teachers do, no matter what. You can't teach common sense out of, I mean, even in a school of education. But parents should know that the teacher may have been taught that she should curb this so-called toxic masculinity, because they've taken healthy, normal, typical boy behavior and turned it into a pathology in need of a cure.
Absolutely. So final question, a concern that I posited in an earlier show on the same topic. considering how some of these gender issues and identity issues have affected the social sciences in academia, it seems like these are now trickling down through young teachers who might have been schooled in these systems of higher education. It's trickling down all the way to elementary school. So before I said, has this penetrated? Maybe not, you know, so explicitly, maybe not so overtly, but I think it has penetrated the lower levels of school, at least in the misconceptions or the attitudes of some of the young people who are teaching there. How would you like to see that addressed and possibly solved?
It's not just that people have a lot of false ideas about kids and about education. They also want to prevent critics from complaining. So that's why we have to protect free expression. And that's become urgent. So if we're going to return to common sense and sanity, we've got to protect free expression. So those of us who are blowing the whistle, we have to be allowed to have our say. And by the way, if we're wrong, if we can't make our case, well, then show that to be so. Don't simply silence us. But right now, on many college campuses, that's what's going on. And it's even worse in high schools and elementary schools because they don't have any speakers. They don't have that. So they just have teachers that came from schools of education where they're taught these standard paranoid views about men and about American society.
Hmm. What about on the lower levels of school for the actual teachers? Like, if you had to give advice to a teacher in one of those systems, and, you know, I don't want to, you know what the title of my show is. And by the way, thank you very much for coming on a show with Sucks in the Title. I really appreciate it. But I don't want to sound like a one-trick pony, but when people spend 15,000 hours, 12 years in this system where they must ask permission to share their thoughts, how good are they going to be at exercising free expression effectively and responsibly once they reach these higher levels of education? So I think it is a problem of free expression at like all levels. What kind of experience do people get with it through most of their education?
It's a good point. But here is where I will show my optimism. I think that what has happened now on the left and this little, like a Berlin Wall they set up against free expression and due process and common sense, it can all come tumbling down. It can fall by the weight of its own madness. And I've had some very good experiences on campus, not with the radicals usually, but with the students in the middle, they recognize that something's amiss, and they can be won over. So again, as long as we keep making the case, I think that in the end we'll win. We have to.
Well, I do want to say that I think you helped me calm down a little bit. I was really on the edge of my seat when I was prepping to do this interview with you. I discovered an article written for the Harvard student newspaper saying we need to get rid of this idea of academic freedom and instead have academic justice.
Oh, gosh, that's so scary. Where have we heard that before?
Exactly. So I think we would have had more negative conversation and I would have been more hostile about all this stuff. But I feel like a couple of shows ago, I got a lot of this stuff out of my system. And I really appreciate you coming on and having this discussion with me. Where can people in my audience learn more about you?
Well, they can go to YouTube, to The Factual Feminist, or I have a website at the American Enterprise Institute, just Christina Summers at AEI.
Excellent. Well, again, I really appreciate it. I hope we can get you back at some point in the future to continue this conversation.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it.
Excellent. Thank you so much.